We've talked a little bit here on this podcast before about the afterlife. You remember, part of the crew, part of the ship. And this week, we'll talk about that a little bit. But the main question we're tackling this week as we wrap up Chapter 8 of The Divine Conspiracy is the long-held discussion around faith and works. What is their connection? Is there a connection? Bonhoeffer called it cheap grace. Willard calls it costly faithlessness. What if death freezes you as the person that you are? What if you aren't transformed instantaneously upon your death? What does it mean to build your house on the sand versus build your house on the rock? What about the sheep and the goats? These are the questions we attempt to answer or start to answer in this episode. Welcome to the Belfast Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Byler, here with Daniel. And we are continuing our series on the Divine Conspiracy. We're in our last episode on Chapter 8 here. And we are going to talk about, this Chapter 8 is on discipleship. We've been talking about what it means to be a disciple, what it means to be a disciple maker. And then now we're going to talk about salvation and discipleship is what we've titled this section. Or you could say action and discipleship. And so there are some really interesting quotes by Willard here that tie, as he's been doing this whole book, tie all of our life into being a student of Jesus, being his apprentice. And some things he says about our soul's condition and our life in the hereafter that are important to keep in mind as we ponder what it means to be disciples of Jesus. And so I guess that's a good place to start with. Let's do something. Let's switch this real quick. Can we read that first Willard quote, and then we'll read the end of Matthew 7?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this Willard quote comes from page 319. He says, "It is now generally acknowledged, as we have noted, that one can be a professing Christian and a church member in good standing without being a disciple. There is apparently no real connection between being a Christian and being a disciple of Jesus. And this is bound to be rather confusing for a person who would like to be a disciple." Now, before we say too much about that, I want to read the Matthew 7 quote. So this comes from the end of the Sermon on the Mount. And I want you to think about the contrast between what Willard just described as the situation in the church now and what Jesus is describing here. So Jesus says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of the Father in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name?' Then I will declare to them, 'I never knew you. Go away from me, you who behave lawlessly.' Everyone then who hears these words of mine and acts on them will be like a wise man who built his house on a rock. The rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who builds his house on sand. The rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat against the house and it fell. And great was its fall."
Lord have mercy.
What is Jesus saying about the relationship between being a Christian and being a disciple in that situation.
That many of those who may claim to be Christians or do things in his name will not make it in the final judgment.
They have no part in the kingdom of heaven. And that's a really scary thought.
Yeah. The
We
problem is, we
love.
usually think it only applies to other people.
Yeah, that too. That too. And we love to talk about grace alone, which I believe, and how, we can't preach works righteousness,
Yeah.
right? Which I believe, but we have to hold in tension with that there has to be some kind of genuine transformation that takes place.
Right.
Because Jesus' call, Jesus' demand is high here. And so we have to figure out a way of holding that grace alone theology in tension with the words of the Savior himself. And I think that's really the thread that you and I are trying to trace through this episode, is trying to figure out how to hold these things in tension, because the church at large, in our opinion, maybe I should just say
Yeah.
my opinion, doesn't do a really good job of that. Luke, any thoughts to add?
No. I think it's something that Willard has said in this chapter, and we've talked about in a couple other episodes, that phrase, there is apparently no real connection between being a Christian and being a disciple of Jesus. This is his whole point in this chapter, is being a disciple. And we'll talk more about what exactly some practices of a disciple are in this next chapter, chapter 9. Might talk about some of them now, but that'll be explicitly what we talk about next. But we see many of these who are disciples or are practicing or are religious, let's say, in some sense, as extra Christian. And I don't know. We'll get into more of why that might be here in a minute. Yeah, and I think you have a note here. And I'll just make this statement quickly. It's in a culture that is so conditioned with Christian history, let's say, it's easy to assume that if you hold a certain set of moral standards or you champion certain causes, that makes you a Christian. Again, this is the right and the left leaning gospel. And so that doesn't seem to be what Willard's arguing for, and it definitely is not. Because it's interesting that these people that Christ is talking about will say to him, "We did these great things in your name." And then he says, "I never knew you." Well, that in some sense might mean it's not, this is also part of Willard's point, is it's not just about the action or just about the state of your mind that puts you in the kingdom of heaven. It's something else.
Yeah, then we'll get into that in a little bit. I mean, Willard's already been there, but we'll get into it again. And so, yeah, you make a really interesting point. So I just got done reading Tom Holland's book, Dominion, and in it, he makes the argument that Western society in general is thoroughly philosophically Christian. And I think he's right. I do think there are some ways in which we now are philosophically pagan. And that's one of the reasons for the culture war. But I think it's interesting because, like, you can have a Christian philosophy without being a Christian, is something that he's very, like, his book will just prove to you, I think. You can also pr you can claim to be a Christian, but I think also have a very pagan philosophy. And so the way that you think, what you claim to believe, and even as Jesus points out in the passage we just read, the way that you act and behave and the things that you do don't necessarily. It's not the barcode that gets you through the pearly gates, right? To use Willard's analogy from earlier, right? Those things don't grant you access to the kingdom. And I think, in particular, many conservatives run into this because there's this predominant perspective in our culture that aligns conservatism with Christianity. And I think there are some good reasons for that and some not so good reasons for that. But I think believing that the conservative worldview is the Christian worldview is a problem. And I think there are going to be a lot of conservatives who will hear Lord, Lord, or who will say Lord, Lord, and we'll hear Jesus' response from this passage. Not expecting it. So, beat up on the conservatives a little bit, but now maybe we should take some time to do the opposite. Luke, can you, I don't know, do you want to pull up that next passage? So,
We've talked about this passage last week. I think it's worth revisiting quickly, and we'll have something else to play here for you in a second. But this here, along with what we just talked about, continues to follow that thread of your works, your discipleship to Jesus, the state of your heart, all of these together need to coalesce into the whole person. So, Willard says this on page 330. He says, at present, in the distant outworking of the Protestant Reformation, with its truly great and good message of salvation by faith alone, that long-accepted division has worked its way into the very heart of the gospel message. This is the case of the missing teacher. It is now understood that to be a part of the good news, that one does not have to be a life student of Jesus in order to be a Christian and to receive forgiveness of sins. This gives a precise meaning to the ch phrase cheap grace, though it would better be described as costly faithlessness.
So this idea of costly faithlessness, I think, is that this passage we read in Matthew 7 is the example of that costly faithlessness, right? A faith that doesn't lead towards, it leads to outward action or profession of certain doctrine or mental assent to certain principles, but it doesn't lead to the transformation of the person. And that's something that just cannot abide. So, Luke, unless you have a comment, you want to pull up the video? This, and I haven't listened to this snippet in a little while, but this is Peterson talking about liberal Protestantism.
We believe that less now because of the decline of religion. So we now think that our outcomes are more determined by our own actions.
Yes, but lurking underneath that is there's a hidden God lurking underneath all that too. It's just that the God has become subjectivity. It's something like that. When God talks to Moses out of the depths of the burning bush, he says, I am what I am. And that's what every degenerate Protestant liberal says now. I am what I am. And they also say, and if you don't go along with it, the consequences for you are going to be pretty damn dismal. Use my pronouns, adopt my identity, play the game that the worst part of me insists on, or else. And it is a consequence. I said Protestant liberalism for a reason. Like, as we've moved away from God, we've moved into a radical subjectivity. Now, the problem with that is that a radical subjectivity, especially one of impulse, is unbelievably immature and counterproductive. It just doesn't work any more than a room full of two-year-olds works.
What's a better idea?
This subsidiary structure. It's the adoption of voluntary responsibility. Way more complex identity. It's like...
Okay. Do you want to play more or is that good enough?
No, that's good. So, I mean, his point being that... So Protestantism was a rejection of a subsidiary hierarchy, right? That was ultimately vested in the Pope. And there are some good reasons why that break was made. I am a Protestant. there were good reasons why that statement was made.
Hey, I don't take the Pope either, so.
Fair enough. but the movement away from a hierarchy that can mediate between and can help consolidate people within fractures infinitely, which is why you see with the advent of the Protestant Reformation continual fracturing that has continued until today. And that fracturing really primarily happens within technically Protestant or Protestant derivative circles.
Yeah.
And so the spirit of Protestantism is ultimately one of protest, right? Protestant. And so this idea that we can all become our own pope is a very popular one right now. And it has also led to the rejection of God himself. Right? So, Luke, I don't know if you have any particular ways that you want to tie this back to the current discussion.
Yeah. We played it because Willard's point here is the distant outwork, this is from his first phrase, the distant outwork of the Protestant Reformation. Mm-hmm. Has made it to where the constant fracturing lower and lower and lower, and the insistence that you are your own interpreter of the Bible, let's say, which is very true, in at least in Protestant circles, because it's, you know, even the pastor will say, check what I say against scriptures, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I think that's done with a good intention, but it makes everybody their own pastor. It makes everybody into their own pope. So then you get this continual fracturing, and then you get this complete separation that Willard is seeing in the, well, for us, it's salvation by faith alone, which means just faith, and by faith they mean mental assent to a set of doctrines. Usually. And Peterson's point here is like, even what we see in secular culture of this demand to engage with me at what I define as my identity or my thing or my, my value, what I think I'm worth, what me is just not working of the same idea of I get to interpret the Bible. I get to say what I think it is. And then you get this canoe fracturing and you get what Willard's talking about here. You get, there is no works. It's just your mental ascent, just your faith alone. And so those who want to be disciples are seen as unnecessary or weird or super Christian.
Okay.
So we beat up on the liberal some, we beat up on the conservative some. Still trying to follow this thread of Jesus and Matthew at the end of the Sermon on the Mount seems to say there's something about your heart and there's something about your action tied together in building your house on the rock.
Yep.
And one of the things that Willard says on the same page. Okay. Willard says on page 330. So Jesus ties something of our lives, of our discipleship, of our spirit, of our, let's say, salvation, because he's talking about those who will not see him at the end, to our heart and our actions. And so Willard says this on page 330. He says, it might prove helpful to think occasionally of how exactly I would be glad to be in heaven should I make it. Will it be like a nice air-conditioned luxury hotel with unlimited room service and spectacular amenities for eternity? I often wonder how happy and useful some of the fearful, bitter, lust-ridden, hate-filled Christians I have been involved with in church or family or neighborhood or political battles would be if they were forced to live forever in the unrestrained fullness of the reality of God, which we try to look at in chapter 3, and with multitudes of beings really like him. And Willard's point here with the integration of our heart, with our actions, with our attitudes, and talking about how, you know, I wonder if someone who is filled with lust or is bitter, is fearful, is hate-filled, how they would actually feel to be in heaven surrounded by God's presence and by holy beings. And this is exactly the question Lewis begs in The Great Divorce. In The Great Divorce, you have a group of people who go from heaven, who take a bus ride to hell, or go from hell, sorry, to heaven. And they are offered the ability to stay. But the contingency that they stay is that they transform. Their thriving in heaven necessitates that they become a different person. And it's interesting because when you read the book, everybody who's barred from heaven, not of God, but of their own free will, of their own desire to leave heaven because they love their children too much. They want what's theirs. They're unforgiving. They're bitter. They're resentful. It's all these small things. They are the things that Willard is talking about here. They are the things that Jesus addresses in the Sermon on the Mount. They are these conditions of the heart, of their attitude, that have made them into this kind of person that can't stand, quite literally, in heaven. And so, with these ideas of what does it mean? What does it mean to be a disciple, to be saved, to go ahead.
Well, so I want to tie this to Peterson's point real quick too, because it's about the kind of person that you are, right? You're not the kind of person who can stand in heaven. And I feel like a lot of people, when they talk about salvation, they think that God is arbitrarily judging people, right? God is saying, you're in and you're out, and you're in and you're out because I said so. And the point that Willard and Lewis are making is that it's not arbitrary at all. The kind of person you are is a key determining factor in how you, like whether or not you can exist in that, in God's presence.
Yes.
Right. Because to exist in God's presence, you have to be someone who is not fearful, bitter, lust-ridden, and hate-filled. To live in heaven, to live in God's kingdom, to live in the new recreated earth, you cannot be that kind of person, because the things that are required for that life are excluded by the kind of person that you are. And that, I think, is a crucial point to make. It's not arbitrary.
Right.
It's deeply ingrained in the kind of person you are and the kind of reality that we live in.
That ties perfectly into the next bit. So I'll read this next quote here. This quote I'm about to read comes directly after Willard's points on cheap grace and costly faithlessness. So he says this. He said, starting in the middle of this paragraph here, he says, moreover, I want to be very clear that I am not saying only true disciples, quote unquote, of Jesus make it to heaven after death. Indeed, I believe that it is not true, though I would not encourage anyone to stop short of discipleship. Nevertheless, I know that as far as forgiveness alone is concerned, the tenderness of God is far greater than we will ever understand on earth or perhaps elsewhere. That is surely what it means to say that he gave his unique son to die on our behalf, that his love and tenderness is far greater than we will understand. I am thoroughly convinced that God will let everyone into heaven who, in his considered opinion, can stand it. But standing it may prove to be a more difficult matter than those who take their view of heaven from popular movies or popular preaching may think. The fires of heaven may be hotter than those in the other place. And then he gives the quote I just read of, it might be helpful to think of occasionally of how exactly I would be glad in heaven if I made it, because I'll be surrounded by God in his presence.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that, and Willard says this in another place, and I'll just reference it instead of us going to read it. The point that Willard is making with all of this is that there's a widespread notion that passing through death transforms the human character.
Mm-hmm.
That all of a sudden you become like this better person just because God gave you grace.
Right.
And that discipleship isn't needed because you can just accept the grace and pass through the pearly gates. Yeah, the barcode will scan. But he says he hasn't been able to find a basis for this. And I think I don't think that's scriptural. He asks the question, what if death only forever fixes us as the kinds of person we are when we die? And if we are, then like, what would we do in heaven if we are not the kind of person who can stand it?
Mm.
Right? Because like, if you're not the kind of person who can stand being in heaven, if you have to be surrounded by loving, kind, caring people who will sacrifice themselves for you, and all you do is take and abuse and are filled with hatred and lust and bitterness, you're not going to be happy there. And you and your presence will cause destruction that cannot stand because of your selfishness. And this is the liberal Protestant thing, right? Because Peterson's point is that the liberal Protestant is the kind of person who demands from others that they meet them on their own terms.
Right.
And that is precisely the thing that cannot persist. Precisely the thing that cannot persist. And so...
Before you move on, this is what Willard says here. This is what, when you read The Great Divorce, this is the seed that it planted in my head, was Willard's exact phrase right here. He says it perfectly. What if death only forever fixes us as the kind of person we are at death? That's what Lewis is trying to get us to think about.
Mm.
This is why this life is given for repentance. And I guess I want to impress upon whoever's listening to think about the fact that I sometimes wonder, I'll put it this way. Many people would, I'd usually hear people say things like, well, I can't wait to leave here, or, you know, when I'm in heaven, X, Y, Z, you know, it'll be so great. You know, it'll be so much better than this place, or, you know, some comment about heaven that is, you know, saying that, you know, well, when I'm finally there, things will be good, or I'll be right. And then I used to think, really? Like, you don't think it's scary to stand before God? And I'm not trying to do this like I want to scare you and like scare you with this to cause a conversion or anything. All I wanted to do is think about this idea. Even so, something as simple as if we find it hard to pray, if we find it hard to forgive our brothers, much less our enemies, if we find it hard to not be overcome by the passions in this life, what happens when all of those things get burned in the fires of heaven? You think that'll be a happy event? Eventually, hopefully, yes, it will be happy for you. You think that'll be enjoyable? Maybe that's a better word. I don't know.
I ask the question.
This is what I ponder.
I ask the question, and this is based off of some St. Isaac the Syrian theology, and we're about to read some from him. But I asked this question to some friends. We were talking about heaven and hell and, you know, these kinds of things one night. And I just asked them, like, what if in order to stand in God's presence, everything, every part of you that isn't worthy has to be burned off? This is the image that's used when Moses goes up Mount Sinai for the first time. The people go up because they see the fires, and Moses enters the fires and they think he's dead.
Right.
But no, he was purified. He comes back down with a face that, it says shines. We think of that as like glowing. But they would have thought it is like burning, like fire. Every part, what do you do? Like, how much of you has to go in order to stand it? And are you willing to let go? I think that's the big question.
Yeah.
So I'll finish us off with this quote from St. Isaac the Syrian. I also maintain that those who are punished in Gehenna, that's hell, kind of, are scourged by the scourge of love. For what is so better and vehement as the punishment of love? I mean that those who have become conscious that they have sinned against love suffer greater torment from this than from any fear of punishment. For the sorrow caused in the heart by sin against love is sharper than any torment that can be. It would be improper for a man to think that sinners in Gehenna are deprived of the love of God. Love is the offspring of knowledge of the truth, which, as is commonly confessed, is given to all. The power of love works in two ways. It torments those who have played the fool, even as happens here when a friend suffers from a friend. But it becomes a source of joy for those who have observed its duties. Thus I say that this is the torment of Gehenna, bitter regret. But love inebriates the souls of the sons of heaven by its delectability. And so his point is that hell isn't this place you go where you're tortured and burned over and over again and like that kind of thing. It's the place you go when you've rejected all that love has to offer because of your own selfish pride, and you suffer because of that rejection. And to Lewis's point, you continue to want that rejection because it means you have to submit yourself to something. That's a terrifying image.